Welcome to Stoma and Continence Conversations from Coloplast Professional. I'm Hannah, Ostomy Care Associate Education Manager at Coloplast. Working in specialist care, I know that stoma and bladder and bowel issues impact the lives of those you care for. This podcast is here to support your educational needs and help you in supporting your patients. You'll hear from fellow healthcare professionals and experts by experience discuss the latest hot topics in the world of stoma, continence care, and specialist practice. Hello, and welcome back to the podcast. This time we're bringing you a chat that Paul had with Scott McKenzie back in June as part of our Webinar Wednesday series. The topic is whether formularies and cost-cutting measures actually save money. To start us off, Paul asks Scott whether formularies work for patients and what the number one mistake is that the NHS makes with them.
Oh, two questions in one. The reason I always smile when you bring up the formulary question is fundamentally where everybody's going to have a different view of the relevance of the formulary and the impact it has on their workload. Number one is we shouldn't be frightened of it. It's there as a guide. It's not law, it's not hard and fast, and it cannot be used as a big stick with which to beat us. But often it's sold as that. It's sold as you must do, and that just isn't the case. But I'm sure we'll explore that in a bit more depth as we go today. Key thing for me is when I'm working with the NHS and we start at any point to get mixed up with or look at the formulary, I find it works best for patients and for clinicians in reality when it's really well defined. And what I mean by that is that the next step is really clear. To further expand that, what you've got to keep in mind is that when a healthcare professional prescribes or refers, they're seeking an outcome for the patient. Prescribe A to reach B. And in my mind, it's if that doesn't happen, what's the next step? What's C to get me to D? And so on. That doesn't happen. What's E to get to F? And at what point is the patient then going to be referred for a second opinion or a different opinion? So within my work, I spend a lot of time trying to work to define what a high quality standardized approach without any unwarranted variation would look like, as the standardized care makes everyone in that team then interchangeable, which can often help in care delivery, particularly when we're short-staffed. I can potentially borrow somebody from somewhere else who's working in exactly the same way, following exactly the same pathway, exactly the same formulary, whereas if you work in varied ways, that's not possible. We can't really interchange them. Additionally, when you work in that way, what you then end up with is you can define everything: the kit and equipment, the drugs, the pathways, the patient education, the referral process, step up, step down care, even the patient discharge. Everything can be defined. And that then frees you to focus on seeing the right patient in the right place at the right time, using the right healthcare professional who's got the skills and resources to deliver the care required. So for me, the formulary is woven through that because it should define the next steps. So we've tried this, it's not worked, here's the next step. We've tried this, that doesn't work, this is the next step, and so on. And often that doesn't happen because the supplementary part to your question, what's the biggest mistake? We get fixated on the cost of the drug, the device, the appliance, the technology, and we forget the true cost of the care, which is actually driven by the contact and the number of contacts the patient has with the NHS. Because they don't get better, they don't get the outcome they're seeking, so they keep coming back. And in effect, the thing to keep in mind is the most expensive product is the one that's defined as cheap because its acquisition cost is cheap and expensive, but it drives appointments, it drives referrals, and it drives admissions because the patient remains unwell. In other words, they don't get the outcome. And I have so many examples of that happening across 18 years of working with the NHS. And unfortunately, it's still happening today, even with the advent of integrated care systems and an integrated budget, where I'm hoping we will see an end to that. I'm unfortunately still seeing the price conversation over the outcome conversation in my work right now. Good example, £20,000 per non-elective admission with a length of stay of 40 days. This is true. This is in mental health in patients with severe mental illness and schizophrenia. So that 20,000 goes up by 50% if the patient is put into an out-of-area bed. So they're sent out of their own area to a completely different hospital. And that is being driven by tablet medicine that costs around £20 per month per patient versus an injectable treatment at £220 per patient. Now, you look at that in stark and you just look at the cost, you're going to go, oh, no, we can't afford the 220. Reality is £20,000 per non-elective admission, £30,000 if they're out of area. And for every four that we treat with the injection, we avoid a hospital admission. So I can leave everybody to work out which is the more cost-effective treatment. And I can tell you that isn't what happens. We end up with the, you will bankrupt the system. And I'm like, no, we've already done that. That's why we've got all these non-elective admissions costing us £20,000. But that conversation is still going on in this day and age.
And it's an almost, not being too melodramatic, it's an upsetting thing to hear when you do hear that, you know. And again, I wouldn't say I'm a fan, because I know that formularies are Marmite.
Yes.
But, you know, there's, you know, I don't think there's any, there's no, I can take them, I don't mind them. It is a Marmite situation when it comes to formularies. You know, some people say, brilliant, they really do support me. Some people say they're not worth the paper that they're written on. And I've taken on board what you've said. You know, it's formularies, you can't look from what you've said, you can't look at formularies in isolation.
No.
Formularies are a, for want of better words, a gear in a bigger machine.
Yes.
To drive improvement, to drive things forward, to drive a better cost outcome, and better outcomes for the patients. But I'm in a very privileged position as Coloplast professional, where I get to speak to a lot of clinical nurse specialists. As you know, my area of speciality is stomacare. But I do get approached by clinical nurse specialists from all different areas. So I, you know, whether it's continence, whether it's diabetes, whether it's wound care, you know, it is, you know, as a wider community of clinical nurse specialists. And I get to hear both of these Marmite arguments. You know, I get to hear the pros, the cons, the positives, the negatives. But it kind of always leaves me with a similar kind of quandary, which is, or almost a statement more than that, is formularies don't drive clinical product choice. They just make products available to use. So how is almost that a true statement?
It is. I often find myself highlighting there can be no restrictions placed on what any healthcare professional chooses to do or prescribe. The reality is there can be no blacklists in terms of you can't prescribe this and you can't prescribe that and restricted formularies, because the clinician always has the choice to prescribe whatever they want. They may then end up having to defend that decision. Ultimately, if there's a problem with the patient or something goes wrong, clearly they're going to have to end up defending whatever decision they make. But reality is they've always got the choice. And even more so if there's a nice technology appraisal, or a nice tag, as they're often called. And if there's anybody sat there thinking, oh, I wonder if that's right, there is a court case from, it's a few years ago now, but a simple search engine of Rose v. Thanet CCG, which went to court and is now not open to challenge, reminded the NHS that when there's a nice technology appraisal in place, you cannot have any form of restriction on what can or cannot happen. It should be made available to the patients. Now, I'm going to add that and quantify it by saying there is a but, because, of course, there's always a but. I always believe it's much better, and it remains much better, to secure engagement in a new product, because we can demonstrate the problem we'll solve and the outcomes that we're going to deliver by offering access to a new product. So that, again, could be around things we've talked about before, around improved patient outcome. Clearly, that's the big one. Then, as a result of that improved outcome, do we reduce unnecessary appointments, referrals, and admissions? You know, are we closing the inequalities gap? Are we redesigning a pathway? Are we delivering on some aspect of the primary care network DES, the Investment and Impact Fund, or QOF? Any of those things are much better to engage around. Funnily enough, my last big formulary interaction was with dry eye disease, of all things, where formulary adherence was 80%, meaning the product really needed to be on formulary to have any chance locally of being used. So how did we do it? It was done by getting a GP lead fully engaged. They then engaged the hospital, and jointly they approached the formulary team with a really well-structured case for change, which highlighted the cheapest chips, as they described it. It costs us 2.5 prescriptions a month per patient versus one of what we're proposing. The 2.5 prescriptions a month was costing them about £12.50. If we used the newer product, it was going to cost £8. And that was how the case for change was won and the product was added to formulary. Equally, with the same project in a different part of the country, formulary adherence was less than 30%. So they just cracked on. There was no point in even starting to have the formulary conversation. So that goes back to your point about it depends is the reality on where you're working and what the adherence is like.
It's really interesting that you say that. You know, it's so, you know, depending, so taking that on board, you know, you've got some areas of the company which will adhere, 80% adherence to a formulary. You've got other places which have got a 20, 30% adherence. And we've already said that formularies, as if they're a standalone, they don't really work. But as a gear in a larger system, they do work. But obviously, and again, we've said it in the last two webinars that we've done.
Yeah.
If something isn't working, if the end result isn't giving us a satisfactory outcome, if that outcome isn't satisfactory, why are we still doing it? Kind of that leads me on to, you know, are there alternatives to developing a formulary? If you're thinking, well, hold on, look, formulary, you know, it's only 20% adherence to the formulary. So why are we spending all of this money, all of this time, all of these resources on creating a formulary that doesn't work? Is it part of education? Is it educating clinicians, etc.? But is there another way we can, you know, standardize care, manage costs without formularies?
Yeah, so again, that goes back to the point we made earlier about one of my drivers is to try and deliver that high-quality standardized approach without unwarranted variation and without boring you. I've got examples of that at play in places like Newcastle upon Tyne, Hartlepool and Stockton, down in Leicestershire and Rutland, down in Coventry and Warwickshire, down into Bath. And I've got lots of examples of that absolutely being done because we take a complete pathway of care. And that's pretty much what I described earlier. That's the alternative to just having a formulary. We actually look at the pathway. We work out the steps in the pathway. We work out then at each step what the treatments are and, of course, what the next step is in terms of, you know, both the treatment and the referral. And if I use, again, I always like to do things on the basis of examples. If I look at one I've got right now, working with a hospital and they're working with one local primary care network. And the project is based on improving patient outcomes where they identified that 80% of workload between the network and the hospital and the referral point was driven by suboptimal treatment, which they split into four categories. So this was kept for 1 month across three hospital consultants and the GP practices. And what we identified was four categories: correctly diagnosed but not on any treatment, correctly diagnosed but not on an appropriate treatment, correctly diagnosed on the correct treatment but not optimally dosed, so therefore not getting the outcome. And sometimes they're neither assessed nor diagnosed, but are being treated. So we've found people in the system who were being treated for what appeared to be a particular condition, but there was no coding for it. So they've potentially never, ever really been formally diagnosed. So the project is very much focused on a complete pathway that addresses that, where patients are being, care plans are being either developed or completely updated. The focus here is to significantly improve the patient outcome because that then has the knock-on effect of reducing unnecessary appointments, referrals and admissions. And it's a project which really surprised everybody involved, apart from the fact that nobody expected that 80% of the workload was being caused by suboptimal treatment. They now know and are working to correct that And they now start every project by looking, is that what's actually driving our problem? Is that part of it? Is suboptimal treatment fueling our workload? So a complete pathway would be the alternative to just having a cold, hard formula, because the pathway then maps out the condition, all the steps that we're likely to see, the various options that we've got, and what you might consider using at that point. And it still leaves the healthcare professional with the freedom to choose what they want based on the patient that's sat opposite them.
Brilliant. And I think, you know, it's really nice to actually hear that, because again, we hear, you know, again, there's lots of things about things like getting it right, you know, getting the NHS, getting it right first time.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is essential. It is growing. We know that it's growing legs. We know that it's developing. Yeah. And personally, I am really, really excited about the future, hopefully, when it comes to get it right first time, because again, I think it is this thing of, it's combining all the knowledge that we have. It's getting those experts and saying, do you know what? This is what best practice looks like. And again, whether you're talking about, again, I know that it all started in orthopedics, but it's spreading out into actually everywhere.
It's a good point. It's a really good point. You know, it's a really good point, because if the alternative is to not get it right first time, and what does that mean? That means the patient's coming back. That's going to keep driving your workload. So the alternative isn't a good one. So if you go back to my right patient, seen in the right place at the right time by the right healthcare professional who's got the resources, the alternative is wrong patient, seen in the wrong place at the wrong time by the wrong healthcare professional who doesn't have the resources but consumes resource doing something that actually isn't the right thing to do. So you don't want that. Nobody's going to advocate that. You know, so this is where getting it right first time is absolutely the route to go. Patient seen, dealt with. It's what the patient wants as well. You know, most people want to get seen, get a correct diagnosis, get early and correct treatment, get a quick recovery and get on with life. And the quicker and easier we make that and we do that, the better it is for everybody involved.
Then that's it. And again, it comes down to that thing of, like we've always been saying, it's almost a mantra for these webinars now, which is starting at the patient and working backwards. Work backwards from there. So I think we're demystifying formularies, because I think for a lot of people, they hear the word formulary and it's almost a case of a formulary is a Excel spreadsheet with a list of products, a list of code, a list of prices. And apparently you have to start at the top, which is the cheapest, and work your way down. You know, I think hopefully we're demystifying that now. And again, you know, so if we utilize formularies, if formularies are utilized in an appropriate way, in the correct setting, then hopefully it is going to improve patient outcomes. It's going to improve everything in. So taking that on board, if a clinician out there, again, any speciality, says, well, I've got a formulary, but I don't know how it is used. I don't know how it is integral to a bigger machine. So how could that nurse interpret that local formulary to drive optimum and patient and excellent patient care if all they know is I've got a formulary?
The thing to keep in mind is it's really as you described, the formulary is and remains a list of products available for use. Whether it's adhered to is a completely different matter. And sometimes, it more often than not, it's where I'll start my work. I do around the formulary. What does the compliance with it look like? Is it high or low? And then we go from there. But the thing that the healthcare professional needs to keep in mind is that they are free to choose. They try and give the patient the best possible outcome. From a patient perspective, it's you know, get seen, get diagnosed, get treatment, get better, get back to life, kind of five steps. And if we keep that in mind, the shortest and safest route is the one that we all want to find. Healthcare professional and patient alike wants that. And actually, that's likely to be the one that's the most cost effective and the most value for money. And I often find it bewildering. Again, I've got a business case just now where locally they spend £42 million a year on non-elective admissions to hospital related to type 2 diabetes, and nobody wants to change anything. So my point being, so we have to be happy that we're spending £42 million and that's going to continue to go up and continue to rise. And the point I'm gently making and politely making is if we implement the nice guidance that's been written over the last, certainly early stuff that was published last year, And then about 18 months before that, if we implement that in full, we would expect to take about 20% out of that. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at taking about 8 million quid out of the non-elective admissions. What do we need to invest to do that? We need about a million quid. It's actually less than that. It's probably about 700, between 750 and a million. So either we, again, going back to what was said in previous webinars, we're 100% happy with where we are, or what are we going to change? So that's where I think the formulary is there. And clearly, if compliance is high, you're probably going to have to get on formulary to get full use, I would say. Not any use, but full use. And that's where it's worth time planning for that. It's worth time, you know, getting to know the medicines optimization team and the key professionals that work around the formulary, key professionals in the area of interest. You know, so whether it's respiratory disease, it's cardiovascular disease, it's diabetes, it's whatever it is. Because even if compliance is low, I'd still want to work with the local optimization team. I'd still want to get them engaged with my project, particularly where I'm really confident my product and my project approach is going to help them do all the things that they want to do around improving the patient outcome. And at the same time, I often look to get the GP and the hospital consultant support for both product and project as part of any approach to make sure that we drive that optimum and excellent patient care and outcome, because the alternative to that is that we don't have excellent patient care and we don't get a great outcome, in which case we get workload because they'll continue to come until they get the outcome that they need.
I think that's it's a brilliant point you kind of made there, which again kind of leads me down to something again that we've discussed in previous webinars, which is nurse is, whether we call it fear, whether we call it worry, whether we call it concern. And you know, I'm in a privileged position because nurses do approach me and they say, Paul, what, you know, this is happening, what can I do? And I have had a rise in the number of nurses that come to me and say, "Put them, what, you know, there's this formulary. I don't want a formulary in my area. I want to have the ability to do X, Y, and Z." And I think I know that hopefully now I'm going to be able to give them that little bit more. If I say, look, don't think of formularies as a negative.
Yeah.
Like I've said, you know, it's, they can be an incredibly a good source of good, you know, again, depending on what the compliance is. And depending on who is on that board, that, again, in my opinion, is who is on that board of who's putting that formulary together, medicines optimization, whether it's GPs, whether it's ICSs, et cetera, et cetera. So I would almost say, please put your head above the parapet, because if you're not involved, if the formulary is being thrust upon you and it's part of a project, it's part of a wider thing, you almost, and it sounds quite harsh, you can't complain if you didn't put anything into it. If you didn't say, actually, no, I need this, whether it's a certain appliance, whether it's a certain catheter, certain drugs, anything, anything on formularies, if you don't put yourself forward and say, I'm actually talking for my patients here, I need to have this, I need to be involved in this selection process. If you're not, and it's just a case of, well, it's going to happen anyway, please, please, please have the passion. We know as nurses, we are incredibly passionate. We always put our patients first. Otherwise, we couldn't do what we do. You know, again, as clinical nurse specialists, a lot of the time we see patients at their lowest. We take them through, a lot of the time, we take them through hell and back.
Yeah.
And we literally by their side all the time. And sometimes I think we have to have that passion and take it almost away from the patient and say, look, it's still going to affect the patient. I need to take this passion forward. I need to move this forward. And that kind of then takes me on to nurses a lot of the time have got their finger on the pulse. They know what is happening, what's coming through, what's, you know, I know this is going to change my patients forever. This is going to change the lives of my patients by innovation, which is all well and good. But again, I'm going to mention those five lovely letters, COVID, that hit. And there has been this incredibly robust and incredibly quick development when it comes to that. But so there's lots of new innovations coming out. But how, if something, if you've got a really good formulary with a really high compliance formulary, how do we get new innovations into it? Especially if it's something that is a complete new category. You know, there's been loads of new categories put out. always developments in it. You know, and again, I think of diabetes with the phone apps when it comes to diabetes and that sort of thing. You know, it turns into best practice. But if there isn't a category, what happens then with formularies?
This is where you need what I would describe as marketplace readiness, where there's a lot of work will need to be done kind of to create the right market conditions, as well as customer and stakeholder readiness and a willingness to even consider using the new product. So let's assume we've got all of that. That's been done. I also know of areas where, for example, a new item will only ever be considered for inclusion on the formulary after a formal written request comes from a consultant. So you've got to keep that in mind as well. There might be various local routes that you need to consider. But this is where things like NICE Technology Appraisal or the Scottish Medicines Consortium, any sort of endorsement with one of those would be a key part, as well as being able, you know, for you to demonstrate the obvious, the proven efficacy, the safety, the quality, and of course the cost is part of that as well. But when it comes to innovative new projects, this is where a small scale pilot can often help you, particularly if you're not getting traction with the medicines optimization team, you know, or at system level or even at place level. This is where rein in your expectations and try for one department, one practice, or a department working with one practice, you know. So, it, you know, whatever disease area you work with, the hospital potentially working with one practice out in primary care to start with. You know, gather all the outputs from day one and start to build a picture of how you're getting on in terms of the improved patient outcome leading to reduced appointments, reduced referral, reduced admissions. You know, if you're completely confident in the delivery, to me, piloting is the way to get your projects live and to actually create the interest, because the natural reaction then of the GP and or the consultant involved is going to be to get the medicines optimization team involved. They're going to want to get them on board and highlight, look, we're doing this, it's small scale, it's not going to get out of hand, we're going to have X number of patients over this amount of time. So it all becomes controllable to start to show, you know, the benefit that you deliver. But it goes all the way back to, it covers right across all three webinars that we've done, that we are, as an NHS, drowning in workload. There is now not enough workforce to meet the demand. So new innovative products, whether it's, you know, tablet treatment, it's devices, it's appliances, it's apps, it's kit and equipment, they're now much more open to that than I would say they've ever been. I see customers that historically we'd never have worked with industry now partnering and actively working with industry for that very reason. So those are the kind of things I would be looking at if it was me taking a new product to market.
What a fantastic chat that was with Scott. We've put together a handout to go alongside this episode, and it's available in the show notes for you to download right now. Thanks for listening to Stoma and Continence Conversations. We'll be back with another episode next week.
Stoma and Continence Conversations is brought to you by Coloplast Professional. To learn more, visit coloplastprofessional.co.uk.